before we get great. Hi, so I want to start with a quote from Holly Lewis in The Politics of Everybody. I think it's in the first chapter as a way to frame this conversation. Holly says, quote, fascist politics can destroy bodies and claim to be doing so for the good of everybody. All it need do is pronounce that some bodies are nobodies. Then it can eradicate the nobodies until everybody is a somebody. We follow that? In the fascist schema, the nobodies are easy to spot. They're the ones without an identity, the ones without a home, the ones without a specific place to be. The internationalists, the immigrants, the street people, the ones whose land has been stolen, the ones stolen from their lands, the ones who never had a land to begin with, the ones who live in the in-between. Now, I want to start here for two reasons. First, we're talking about anti-Semitism, and of necessity, we're going to be talking a lot about fascism. I think there's an inherent connection between these two things, as we'll get into later. I also think, though, that this quote primes us for the purposes of the discussion today to be thinking about anti-Semitism in broader ways than the left is usually able to do. I think it's been a real flaw in left-wing and Marxist analysis of anti-Semitism. Up until about a year and a half ago, the left was pretty much only able to conceive of anti-Semitism in its most explicit forms. And this led to a lot of, I think, wrong conclusions. Either that anti-Semitism was on its way out, it was only interpersonal, it wasn't really a thing. And in the last year and a half, a couple of developments have changed that. You have a dramatic increase in the frequency and scale of those most explicit expressions of anti-Semitism. You, of course, have the appearance of that anti-Semitism in the highest levels of government. And you have a return of anti-Semitism to a sort of at-homeness in the in mass politics, like on the streets, famously the Charlottesville. And when this happens, the movement goes from has to switch really rapidly from anti-Semitism is on its way out to now explaining how Jews are arguably the most hate-grouped demographic in the United States today. And I think there's a big what the hell happened that is justified or that is called for by that real failure of analysis. And so that's what I'm going to spend most of my time on today is answering that question of what happened. And sort of give an explanation for this explosion of anti-Semitism that we saw in 2016, 2017. First, I think it'll be helpful for me to go through some of the other answers that have come up. There's a really rich literature that has come out from the Jewish left since approximately Charlottesville, which I think is really instructive about anti-Semitism. I don't think we've got it right yet, but I'm going to go through some of that. And the first lens that I want to go through is encapsulated in a pamphlet that came out in 2018 called The Past Didn't Go Anywhere, written by April Rosenblum. Basically, the argument is 2017 is basically a vindication that centrist Jews were right all along, that anti-Semitism is a cyclical, omnipresent, ahistorical phenomenon. And the reason why it was silent before is that anti-Semitism works differently from other oppressions. See, while other oppressions function primarily through the limiting of resources and access of oppressed groups, anti-Semitism works by actually giving resources to some, to at least some Jews, resources and power, so that anti-Semitism has the scapegoats that it needs, right? I think there's a couple of problems with this. I think first of all, it fails to take seriously the role that white Jews in particular played in white flight and actually the construction of our own whiteness in this country and all of the racism that goes along with that. But I think the bigger problem is that it assumes that the reason anti-Semitism works is because there are rich, powerful Jews around. And I think that's problematic theoretically. I think it's also not borne out by the historical record. You have heights of anti-Semitism, certainly at periods where there are rich, powerful Jews to point to, but in, you know, early 20th century Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire, Jews are one of the most impoverished ethnic groups in the empire. You know, and even the Jewish ruling class is so poor it often cycles back and forth between sort of layers of the petit bourgeoisie and the proletariat. So I don't think that I don't think this analysis works, but I think it gets right that there's something to talk about here. That anti-Semitism didn't the title The Past Didn't Go Anywhere I think is helpful, and I want to contrast this to a second response, which is encapsulated by many of the essays in the collection from Jewish Voice for Peace on anti-Semitism, which is basically that despite the dramatic rise in anti-Jewish prejudice, the anti-Semitism as a structural force, something like that just can't come out of thin air. And so that they see the sort of propagation of anti-Jewish prejudice as simply that, an increase in prejudice. And according to this perspective, creating movements free from anti-Semitism is important, but when we're talking about fighting anti-Semitism, really what we need to be doing is fighting white supremacy, colonialism, imperialism. These are the forces that generate anti-Semitism and the prejudice reaction that we see. I think this perspective, to its credit, works really well as a corrective to the first, right? And it has the benefit of creating a real basis for solidarity between Jews and non-Jews. This is why JVP has been, I think, successful in some ways that other Jewish formations, namely, if not now, has not been. Is that JVP profoundly understands itself as part of a broader movement led by folks of color against the system of white supremacy, almost to its own detriment, I think. I think it fails where Rosenblum succeeds in seeing that the threat posed by anti-Semitism today isn't just simply another prejudice. I think Jews are in a disadvantaged position with respect to Christians, even, and I don't think this is the case, but even if you only view that as due to intergenerational violence. And since that's the case, we have a number of systems, cultural artifacts and subcultures, people in power that are specifically anti-Semitic and need to be fought on those grounds in order to dislodge anti-Semitism. I don't think the prejudice approach actually gives you grounds to do that. Third, this is my favorite of the approaches, is the one proposed by Eric Ward in an article that's gone around the movement a lot called Skin in the Game, How Anti-Semitism Animates White Nationalism. Check me after the colon. But it's called Skin in the Game. And basically the idea here is that anti-Semitism becomes, after the 1930s, becomes inoperative in mainstream politics but is kept alive in fringe politics. And that Jews, the current moment, basically reflects Jews' contingent access to whiteness because the forces of white nationalism keep anti-Semitism alive, and in fact necessarily so. That anti-Semitism plays a structural role within the ideology of white nationalism, that white nationalism can't happen white nationalism can't happen without anti-Semitism. I find this argument compelling because I think it understands well the connection between anti-Semitism and fascism. That these two things are inherently linked in terms of how Jews are going to be experiencing anti-Semitism. I find it uncompelling in two ways. First, I think that, well, I'll skip that. I find it uncompelling in one main way. Which is that, like all of the answers, it assumes this narrative arc where anti-Semitism is a thing in the 1930s, it's a thing now, and it's not really around in the in-between, especially in mainstream politics, and that's kind of what I want to take Eric Ward up on in this talk. First, I'll give a little bit of background on, how am I doing on time, Sean?
You have like 8 minutes.
8 minutes? Ooh, nice. Okay, well, I'll abbreviate this next section, which was supposed to be sort of a survey of anti-Semitism prior to the point of debate, right? Prior to when anti-Semitism is supposed to have gone away or at least become non-structural. I'll say that I think anti-Semitism post sort of industrialization, but also after, like, along with the rise of really the domination of the nation-state form in Europe, anti-Semitism undergoes some fundamental changes. It's no longer primarily a religiously based set of myths about Jews. Rather, it focuses more on situating anti-Semitism within the politics of the day. So in a context dominated by nationalism, Jews become disloyal to the nation. They become nomadic or always outsider, even when they're staying in one place. And they become overseers or oppressors whenever they intervene in mainstream politics, in particular, whenever they intervene on the side of anti-oppression movements, ironically. This is one of the main, like, sort of mental games that anti-Semitism plays. So I won't go into all of that, but I think in this point, in Europe, there's a complex relationship between this anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitism of the Middle Ages, because all of that stuff is still there, right? I mean, modern Europe, the idea of modern Europe was forged in no small part by the dispossession and genocide of Jews. Think the Crusades, in the First Crusade, a third of Europe's Jewish population was killed. In the United States, there's a much less complex relationship because that history of dispossession and genocide of Jews is not present. And so the first rise in explicit political calls for some kind of violence to be done against Jews is in this period of post-industrial, post-nation state anti-Semitism. I think a couple things happen in World War II and the decade after. First of all, the Holocaust has a huge impact on the world, the politics of American society, particularly the horror at it, but also the way that the American nationalist project capitalizes on the legitimacy that it can gain from fighting the Nazis and fighting the Holocaust. Both make a really hostile environment for explicit expressions of anti-Semitism. Second, white flight. Jews, and actually white Jews and to some extent Jews of color, participate in white flight post World War II, and this dramatically changes their access to wealth and resources. And just a little over 10 years later, you have the U.S. embracing Zionism full-throatedly as it moves into the position of the State of Israel's main benefactor, basically after the Second Arab-Israeli War. And this expectedly leads to a dramatic decrease in explicit anti-Semitism. But here's where I want to take on Eric Ward, is that anti-Semitism, his argument hinges on anti-Semitism leaves mainstream politics but stays in fringe politics. I want to actually argue that that's actually not true. So folks in this room will be familiar with some of this history, that in the 1950s, McCarthyism is a huge force of anti-Semitism, right? Not in an explicit way, but certainly in an implicit way, and certainly in terms of its effects. A whole bunch of examples of this. Six out of the Hollywood ten are Jewish. You have the execution of the Rosenbergs during this time. Jews are consistently targeted as disproportionately likely to be Soviet provocateurs, agents, whatever, right? And what I think happens after this point is that colorblind anti-Semitism actually remains very much alive and well on the American right, and I'm going to talk about a little of that. I think in the 1960s, we see this in the form, in response to the civil rights movement, right-wing anti-communism, which embraces this, the ideology of anti-Semitism as it has done since the early 20th century in Europe and in the United States, is full of anti-Semites and anti-Semitic attacks result from this. You also have the rise of a mass sort of ideology of outside agitators, which is always, again, hinged around this idea of the Jews as nomads coming into communities, stirring up working class, and especially communities of color, to resist. In the 1970s, you have post-civil rights movement, the new right emerging, you see the new right doubling down on a set of nationalist and anti-Jewish sort of politics that emphasize the folk or the nation as the unit of analysis, and sees all kinds of attacks in this, in anti-Christian liberal elites coming after the things that make the everybody in Holly Lewis's terms, right? Think about things like Christian morals, temperance, heteronormative gender and sex roles. These things are all at risk by this group of liberal elites. And since then, you see a more libertarian wing of America's right emerging that has a lot to say about political correctness and the way that a move towards speech, which is less oppressive, is more oppressive to everyday regular Americans. And obviously by this, what is meant is white middle class and working class people. Now, I sketched this out in terms of the outward-facing political projects of the right wing. I just as easily could have sketched it out with respect to individual actors and trends in the material development of anti-Semitism. I don't have time to go through all that. Believe me, there's a lot of anti-Semitism behind closed doors. I'll pick one example, which is that there are widespread reports of deep, profound cultures of the most explicit Jew hatred in Republican presidential administrations going as late as the Bush administration. That's not to exclude Trump, we're talking about a different period, right? Figuring out, I'm gonna go, we're at like 15, right?
You got a moment.
Okay. I'm gonna go closer on the 20-minute mark. Is that okay?
Go for it.
I have 2 points. So, a previous version of this talk focused on the argument that anti-Semitism is structural oppression. I ditched that because I don't actually care if anyone takes those two words away from this. I'm not even sold on both of them entirely myself. I don't think that's a takeaway. But I do have 2 takeaways from that argument that I want people to take away. That was a lot. First, we can't look at out-of-context statistics and facts to prove or disprove the existence of oppression. People can talk about, and with good reason do talk about, the access of Jews to privilege and wealth based on all kinds of statistics about income and education. These are really important because they paint a picture of how whiteness functions in the Jewish community. I can also pull statistics that show, for example, that Jews are 40% overrepresented among America's prisons. Now, I don't think that is actually a sign that mass incarceration is targeting the Jews. My point here is that neither of these 2 statistics actually provide the full picture. I think we've learned this lesson when we're talking about other so-called model minorities in America. I think we could do well to apply that lesson to understanding anti-Semitism, taking a holistic view of a group's experience in our society. Second, I want people to take away that the impact of decades of colorblind anti-Semitism is not just that some Jews are made uncomfortable or even to be found just in the hate crimes that it has inspired. Actually, I think there is a structural role on the reproduction of capitalism that this kind of anti-Semitism that I've described as central to the right-wing political project over this period. You know, my argument is that the right wing, in the same ideological project that is as it is going after people of color and immigrants and LGBTQ people and all of these other scapegoats, is also really invested in directing working class anger at some sort of mystified liberal elite, which is coded profoundly because of all of the histories of anti-Semitism as Jewish. Let's see. I talked a lot about anti-Semitism. This isn't actually a talk about that. This is a talk about fighting it and Jewish politics and its relationship to anti-Semitism. Okay, I've got 2 minutes to go in my 20 minutes, so I'm gonna give a couple takeaways for what I think the movement needs to do around anti-Semitism. First, how we talk about it. I want to ban the words trope and dog whistle from all conversations of anti-Semitism. I'm being a little facetious. The point here is that when we use trope and dog whistle, we're talking. What we're basically saying is, you might not know that this is anti-Semitic. This is unintentional. But let us, let's explore this deeply. And actually, what I think is, I think this betrays a sort of conciliatory attitude towards the left, where when we hear colorblind forms of other kinds of oppression, we're really good at recognizing them and calling them out. Even if the speakers don't intend to be racist, for example, we're good at calling out. And now we need to understand the anti-Semitic rhetoric that I've talked about here as anti-Semitic. And then a couple of things around mobilization. I'll stick with 2. Anti-fascism is really important and needs to be at the center of left-wing politics. We also need to conceive of anti-fascism not just as targeting individual right-wing groups, but actually see the whole network of actors, both state and non-state, that are actually pushing forward fascist politics in this country as the target of anti-fascist work. I'm thinking of ICE, the cops, right, the whole system that is actually collaborating more and more closely during this period. And that is central to our ability to actually uproot anti-Semitism. And so if you're interested in that project, we need to be doing that. I also think for Jews in particular, we need to revive a radical Jewish politics that sees itself as an agent of our own liberation. White folks have gained immeasurably on the fight against racism, like anti-black racism from radical black folks coming to the movement, seeing themselves as an agent of their liberation, and we are more able to get it right because of the work that those comrades have done in educating us and in training us to fight racism. Jews, if we expect the movement to be able to take on anti-Semitism appropriately, we have to play that same role. It's not going to happen without us.
All right. Thank you, Jonah. Some of my talk will be rather similar, I think. Because, you know, if you have two Jews, you have only one opinion. So I would just start by saying it's a slightly odd, by the way, is my mic working well enough?
You might want to bring it closer.
Okay, yeah.
Also, it comes out if you want
to do that. No, that seems too rock star for me. All right. It's a slightly odd moment to be Jewish in the United States right now. On the first hand, we have the first openly anti-Semitic presidential campaign, and the first moments, really, of public anti-Semitism in at least a generation. Of course, you have Trump's famous tweets, the Charlottesville March, Tree of Life shooting, etc. And this is really the first time you've seen anti-Semitism in public life, at least since the Nixon administration. If you ever want a good education on what anti-Semitism sounds like behind closed doors, I encourage you to listen to the Nixon tapes. Also, it answers the interesting question of, people always say, how can Trump be anti-Semitic? He has Jews in his cabinet. People actually explicitly asked Nixon this, and he said, well, my Jews are okay. Anyways, their Jews are always okay. And of course, before that, you had McCarthy, the Red Scare, and McCarthyism, which, as Jonah mentioned, was intensely anti-Semitic, and I think actually in very explicit ways. If you look at, for instance, at images of the anti-communist conspiracies, it looks very much like images from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Two-thirds of the Gulag testimony defendants were Jewish, of course, the Rosenbergs, etc. My own grandparents, who were communists, referred to it as an American pogrom, and they were not exaggerating. But this has gone away for a while. Like I said, it's been out of public life at least for 40 or 50 years. And I think it encouraged a lot of people to think that anti-Semitism was over. At the same time we have the reemergence of public anti-Semitism, we also have false claims delivered and leveled at actual anti-racists. So Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, etc., are being accused of anti-Semitism when they are people who have been the natural allies of Jews and in the fight against racism, at least for the last generation. So we're living in this bizarre, contradictory moment when anti-Semitism and claims of anti-Semitism are everywhere, and everyone's talking about it, and no one seems to actually know what it means. And I think, though, these two moments are not just a question of confusion. They're actually moments, you could say, a Gramscian crisis of legitimacy around the term itself. So I want to go over two, I think, rather bad ways of thinking about anti-Semitism that have come up recently, and think about some of the reasons and why these bad readings of anti-Semitism are still with us. And I think in some ways, these bad readings of anti-Semitism are still with us because, as leftists often do, we're fighting yesterday's battle, right? So we're thinking in terms that we've inherited from the 1960s, and that's often what we do. There's nothing new about that. But I think this also encourages us to think in new ways about not only how Jews been sort of repositioned in the American fabric of life, but also what this new rise of a discourse of anti-Semitism can tell us about the crisis of hegemony and legitimation the ruling class is experiencing right now. So the first one, there's this horrible book that came out last year by Deborah Lipstadt called Anti-Semitism Here Now. And I've been trying to come up with like a joke title for this book for like a year, and I really failed. But anyways, it's a horrible book. And she's a well-known Holocaust scholar. She teaches at Emory. She was famous for actually suing
David Irving.
Yes.
David
Irving. Thank you.
No, he sued her. He sued her.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. All right. Anyways, glad people know this. And thank you for interrupting. Anyways, yes, very welcome. Where were we? Yes. Anyways. Book has been everywhere. You know, it's been interviewed. You know, there's been written up in the New York Times. She's been interviewed on NPR. She's been all over the radio and print and online media. And her argument is pretty simple. Basically, anti-Semitism has returned, and it is indistinguishable on the right and the left. And so her book basically says Jeremy Corbyn is the same as Donald Trump, even though Jeremy Corbyn, to my mind, has never actually uttered a single anti-Semitic statement in his life. In fact, actually, the first political act, as I understand, that he did was a rally against fascism in the Jewish neighborhood in London. And somehow he is the same as Donald Trump, who has uttered anti-Semitic statements in public many, many times. And she gets away with this by suggesting that anti-Semitism, essentially she defines it as an infection or a virus, that basically somehow the body politic has refused to take its vitamins in the last few years, and this infection of anti-Semitism has simply magically reemerged, and it has no target or necessary even prime host, right? And it can sort of infect anybody. So Jeremy Corbyn just happened to catch the anti-Semitism bug, and so did Donald Trump, and somehow this is her explanation of the rise of anti-Semitism. It's a deeply reactionary book. Like I said, most of the book is spent criticizing the left and thinking about anti-Semitism as rising from this also nebulous form of what she calls illiberalism. And so you can be a left illiberal or a right illiberal, and somehow it is all the same. And I'll get into where I think that idea comes from and why it's wrong, but also why it's very important for the liberal intelligentsia right now. Like, this book is, if you read it, obviously nuts. I mean, it's just a bad book. But I'm always very curious about why bad books in certain moments become very popular. I think like bad books becoming popular in certain moments actually tell us more than why good books become popular, right? So good books become popular, oftentimes they're good books. When a bad book becomes popular, it tells you there's some collective madness going on. So we'll talk about that in a second. The other bad form of anti-Semitism, and I think Jonah has alluded to this, is oftentimes embraced actually by my own organization, Jewish Voice for Peace. There was an interview in Boston Review a month or so ago by Donna Neville and Mark Singh Putterman, in which they basically said, most claims of anti-Semitism are either pro-Israel Hasbara that have been circulated by the Jewish National Fund or World Jewish Federation, and this is actually absolutely true. So if we want to think about some of these false claims of anti-Semitism, yes, they belong to a general kind of right-wing propaganda machine, but they are very specifically generated by large, mainstream, well-funded Jewish organizations that have increasingly aligned themselves with the right. So the World Jewish Federation, again, Jewish National Fund, ADL, etc. But they go on to say that basically anti-Semitism is merely a marginal form of prejudice. They even make the claim that a Nazi flag has no specific anti-Semitic content, which to me, struck me as a rather odd comment, right? So obviously, a Nazi flag doesn't only have anti-Semitic comment, but of course, anti-Semitism is very central and vital to a Nazi and right-wing ideology, and as Joni mentioned, right-wing ideology would actually be incomprehensible without anti-Semitism as its engine. And that's really the basis of their claim. They want to basically say there's nothing special or unique about anti-Semitism that deserves special merit. And the reason they say this, though, I think it actually comes, and I say this with full of love and respect for Jewish Voice for Peace, like I said, as an organization that I've been a proud member of for quite some time, they want to say this because we live in a settler colonial country built on the backs of slave labor. And obviously, land theft and anti-black racism is central to the way capitalism functions, right? You don't have capitalism without slavery. You don't have capitalism without the theft of Native American land. So anti-blackness and the theft of indigenous land are absolutely vital, again, to the functions of capitalism. And in some way, you could say JVP is almost being sort of almost like vulgar Marxism without the Marxism, right? So they say, well, basically, of course, it's central to capitalism, and only things that are central to the accumulation of capital at the point of production or reproduction, therefore, are real forms of racism. And that's always the bizarre part of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism in the U.S. at no point has been central to the accumulation of capital, you know, in the way in which slavery was central to the accumulation of capital. You do not have the engine of American wealth without slavery. And you can make an argument that anti-Semitism is an institutionally important in terms of consolidating ruling class thought and ruling class ideas, but again, not the point of production, right? So you don't have an actually segregated labor market where Jews work over here and African Americans work over there. And so, like I said, as a frequently vulgar Marxist, I am sympathetic to this point of view, and it pains me actually to have to critique something that posits itself as materialism. But like I said, in this particular case, I think it's a little wanting. actually, as my colleague and friend Paul Mischer said, when I read that piece, it did make me a vulgar Marxist because I found myself swearing reading it. So, anyways, I want to take a step back though and think about. Fewer jokes. Okay. I want to take a step back though and think about the historical moment that we're in and why anti-Semitism and the discourse of anti-Semitism has been really important for the project of liberal consolidation after 1945. As Jonah mentioned, the defeat of fascism was not only a world historical development, but it's also been a large part of the narrative of the American West, right, and the European West. It is part of its legitimation, right? The Nuremberg Laws, the Nuremberg Trial, the notion that we, the sort of American global empire is an empire of the rule of law, right? So this is very much encoded in not only American mythology of itself, but even organizations like the IMF and the WTO. We are different from the kind of accumulation that was engineered by fascism or British colonialism that exercised outside the law. American empire has been very much a legal construction, right? And it justifies and legitimates itself by saying, basically, capital follows the rule of law. And we are different, again, those nasty British, those nasty, and they're very explicit about this. If you read, actually, Gendon and Panish, The Making of American Global, we're making a global capital, making American, make, global capital. Making a global capitalism. Yes, they're very explicit about this, that they want to be different than the British, they want to be different than the Nazis, because they saw the Nazis and the British as empires that worked outside of the legal framework, right? So engineering a legal framework was very central to the idea of America as an empire that could legitimate itself through a kind of universality. And the incorporation of Jews, both discursively and materially, into that empire has been a very central part of American empire's legitimation. So this materially could actually look at, you know, for instance, there's a huge inrush of liberal Jews into the defense establishment, you know, after World War II. You have people like Daniel Ellsberg, Lionel Trilling became, you know, one of the most important literary critics, Morton Halperin. And they brought this kind of liberal, rule-based universality into the Pentagon, into the State Department. And, you know, Daniel Ellsberg, you know, released the Pentagon Papers. That was basically part of his problem. You know, I believed in American liberalism. I believed in the empire of liberty, and it has broken my heart, you know, and so therefore I'm releasing the Pentagon Papers. And so, you know, of course, he actually believed in sort of the mythos of the American empire that he was serving for many, many years before he released the Pentagon Papers. And of course, you also have, you know, the strange thing about the Rosenberg trial, as Jenna mentioned. So the Rosenberg trial was not only anti-Semitic, it was also a kind of Jewish passion play, right? So of course, the judge was Jewish, the prosecuting attorney was Jewish, the lawyers were Jewish, of course, the Rosenbergs were Jewish. What you really had, essentially, was a purging by the liberal Jewish establishment of their dirty radical cousins, right? So if you can do this thing, if you can push the Rosenbergs out, if you can push the communists out of your unions, out of the liberal establishment, then you can be incorporated into the state and incorporated into liberal America as part of this project of American liberty and American empire. And of course, Israel is part of that, right? So Israel also became incorporated into American liberal planning and was seen as the quote-unquote only democracy in the Middle East, was, you know, an important ally against, of course, also the forces, as American military planners saw them, as illiberalism, you know, pan-Arab nationalism, and et cetera. So of course, Israel, one of the reasons why Israel, of course, I think, has become many, one of the many reasons why it drives the liberal establishment nuts, because Israel also shows the lie of liberalism, right? So Israel poses itself as this liberal democracy in the Middle East, but it's this liberal democracy based on exclusion, right? Which is the basis of liberalism from the very beginning. Liberalism has always been based on this universality that has at its root certain exclusions, right? And Israel is just that writ large, 1,010%. And so what we're seeing now, and I think, like I said, one of the reasons why this discourse of anti-Semitism mobilized by the liberal establishment such as Deborah Lipsitz is so hysterical at the moment, pardon the term, is so overblown, so overwrought, is they see their own liberal project falling apart. And that's what's happened in the last 10 years. The project of American empire, the project of American universality, the project of American rule by law is in crisis, right? It's in crisis in the sense that the Democratic Party, liberal establishment of the Democratic Party is in crisis. It's in crisis because you have far-right governments that basically run on nationalist platforms in Europe and around the world, are rejecting, for all the wrong reasons, but nonetheless rejecting the project of American liberal empire. And of course, you also have the geopolitical rise of China and the exposure of states like Israel as basically being apartheid states. So you have a liberalism in crisis right now. And so one of the reasons why these plain false claims of anti-Semitism have both the power and have the almost, you know, over-caffeinated feel to them, like the sense that they are just an overdrive, finding any excuse, anybody to target more and more desperately, is because their very process, program is falling apart, right? And so, you know, you have Harris, Kamala Harris said kind of amazingly recently that she is pro-Israel and attended an AIPAC meeting because she believes in civil rights and was a daughter of the civil rights movement, right? And that sounds to us now like an insane statement, but in the 1960s, that was the liberal consensus, right? That Israel is part of the global civil rights consensus. The Jews, once an oppressed minority, are now, you know, brought into this Judeo-Christian West, right? And of course, you have the entire notion, right, that what replaces the Judeo-Bolshevik is the Judeo-Christian West, right? And so this program is in crisis, this process is in crisis, and they're freaking out and they don't know what to do. The other part, though, of the story is what's wrong with the JVP narrative, right? I think the JVP narrative is also locked in the past. They're locked in this moment of the 1960s. In which the global fault line, again, was a global fault line of race. It was a global fault line of empire, and the struggle was basically a binary struggle between the forces of European colonialism, American colonialism, and internal colonization, and basically a liberal white supremacy, right? And that project as well has gotten complicated, right? So we live in basically the post-civil rights era. You have the incorporation of a very thin layer of an African-American political class, and of course the liberal consensus around anti-racism has also fallen apart, right? So what you see now is a sort of reemergence not only of explicit racism, but also explicit and institutional anti-Semitism, right? And yes, anti-Semitism may not be structural in this vulgar Marxist way, in the sense that it is necessary for the accumulation and reproduction of capital, but it's certainly institutional. Like, there are actual political institutions that benefit from and circulate and reproduce anti-Semitic thought, which makes it different than, say, for instance, anti-Italian bigotry or anti-Polish bigotry, which still exists in corners, but there's no actual institutional force or form that produce and reproduce it. So, for instance, Christian evangelicism, and of course the rise of the far right, and of course the rise of the Tea Party right as well, are sites of institutional anti-Semitism, right? And if you spend any time watching Fox News, this stuff is all over the place, right? You know, George Soros-ness. So George Soros-ness, the trope of... tropes. New York values, et cetera. Metaphors, symbols, metonymy, I like to just conclude by a quote by Hannah Arendt in her very prescient essay on anti-Semitism that she wrote in the late 40s. And if you haven't read this essay, in one sense it's dated, because it's pre-Holocaust, it's also pre-state Israel, pre-post-45 liberalism, but she does one really important thing in this essay, which is basically, she says, anti-Semitism is not a transcendent fact in world history. It's not always the same. It doesn't exist in every moment. But it gets organized in particular moments, this sort of floating anti-Semitism, floating ideas of prejudice, get consolidated at certain political moments and certain moments in European history for very certain reasons. And she says, widespread antipathy toward Jews becomes dangerous only when it can link itself with other political trends. I'll say that again. Widespread antipathy toward Jews only becomes dangerous when it can link itself with other political trends. And so what she's basically saying is that anti-Semitism is always a political project, right? It is a political and discursive project that is about taking power in a Gramscian way for certain social forces. And I think that's the other reason why it's reemerged, right? We're in this moment of sort of Gramscian crisis in which the ruling class is in crisis, working class is in motion, and suddenly people are scrambling essentially to create new discursive forms of political consolidation. And anti-Semitism is by far not the only way that that's happening, but it's one of the major ways in which new ruling class formations are trying to reorganize themselves, right? And so if we want to think about our moment in a kind of world historical sense, of course, anti-Semitism is not the only thing we need to be thinking about. It is not necessarily even always the major flashpoint on the far right. But if we want to understand the new ideologies of the right and how they're trying to reform, I think understanding anti-Semitism is going to be absolutely and totally essential.